now, the man behind the voice you've been hearing for decades associated with Valley sports teams, ASU broadcaster Jeff Munn. It's time for That's So Money.
Well, hi there, and thanks for checking us out on That's So Money podcast that comes to you. And I've been a little bit more diligent about updating this thing a little bit more often here at sports360az.com. Lord knows I have the time. And I've got a number of items to get to talk with you about. But I'm going to start, as I have the last several times, by urging you to send me a line. Drop me a note at Moneyball on Twitter. If you have questions or comments about things going on in sports that you'd like to hear me discuss, or if you have some thoughts to share of your own, I'd love to discuss them on this podcast. I don't want this to be a one-way conversation. So if you have some things, some opinions to share, for goodness sakes, please share them with me at Moneyball. And I promise we're going to update this podcast on a lot more frequent basis, and we will get to those comments and questions as often as we can, because I do like to hear what's on your mind. I already know what's on my mind. So, we have several items to get to, and I had actually recorded a podcast a couple of days ago. We're recording this on Friday, March the 25th, Good Friday, and I had recorded a podcast a couple of days ago, and then things change. News items happen, and you kind of feel compelled to go back in and start over and say, okay, we're going to do a new, totally new version of the podcast. Now, I'm in the Sports 360 AZ Studios because today I filled in for Brad on his show. So some of what I'm going to say, you might have already actually heard me say when I did the show for Brad on March 25th. And, of course, you can check out archive Brad Sesmatch shows at sports360az.com. All right. Now, a lot of you, I'm certain, are saying, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, what does Jeff think about this whole thing with the D-backs and the stadium and the lease and what have you? I don't have a lot of inside knowledge on the lease. In fact, I have none. But here's what I can share with you from my perspective, and these are opinions only. They're not really totally based in fact. What Derek Hall did in writing that letter to the county was what he is basically charged with doing as the president and CEO of a business. And we have to be reminded sometimes very unfortunately, that sports is a business. And as much as it rankles people to hear things discussed about taxes and finances in an industry that is thriving financially like baseball, there is a due diligence factor. And Derek is charged with maintaining the security financially of his business. Now, I don't know, because I don't have a copy of the lease, I don't know who is responsible at the end of the day for $187 million in repairs and maintenance to Chase Field. But I do know this, there is a need to do repairs and maintenance. And what I would like to see, as somebody who cares about Chase Field and cares about the franchise that I worked for 19 years, I would like to see legal representatives of both sides in this dispute get together away from cameras and microphones and settle it, solve it, figure out a clear interpretation of the lease, so that everybody's on the same page about who is responsible for what. It can be done. The unfortunate thing is, by bringing it out in the light of day, in the public, it tends to slow the process down. And that is the real tragedy of all this, the two press conferences that were held the day before. This now becomes a very public issue. I'm not saying keep it secret in backroom deals. I'm just saying you tend to get things done a little bit faster when you just deal one-on-one, and you don't try to do things through the media. I don't blame the D-backs for the press conference they had, because they felt a need to explain their side of the story. But it does tend to slow the process down. And I'm certain that, number one, nobody wants a long, protracted dispute, argument over all this. Derek Hall doesn't want to spend his time delivering statements to the media about his relationship with the county stadium district. He wants to concentrate on baseball. He wants to concentrate on the potential for a playoff team with the D-backs in 2016. And to that end, I would hope that at some point soon, the legal representatives of both parties can work something out. We had Jude LaCava on the show that I hosted for Brad, and he said it, and I agree with him. The D-backs are not leaving the Phoenix market. They may relocate to a suburb. They may relocate to a Native American community, but they are not leaving Phoenix. I don't necessarily agree that downtown, the location of a ballpark downtown, poses a problem in terms of attendance. There has been some speculation that the specific area of downtown where the ballpark is located in an industrial district does pose a problem. I don't necessarily agree with that either. Downtown is an ideal location to build a sports facility because of the retail opportunities, the development opportunities, and transportation. Every major traffic artery in a major American city points to downtown. That's why teams should always try to do whatever they can to put their facilities downtown. Okay, I've drained that subject dry. And as I said on Brad's show, I promised I would get on to other things, and I will. All right, item number two. There has been a lot of gnashing of teeth about Oregon getting a number one seed in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. And as we tape this podcast, they just defeated Duke last night in the Sweet 16 and are going to the Elite Eight. It is time for the East Coast media, and I mean specifically ESPN, to admit once and for all that they do have a bias toward teams on the East Coast. This is not a terrible thing. ESPN has a television contract with the Pac-12, and they show Pac-12 events. Through their myriad of channels, they show basketball games from the West Coast Conference, from the WAC, from the Big West, from the Mountain West. So it's not as if they have a bias to the extent that they won't show teams in the West. They show them, but when their key commentators, the Seth Greenbergs, the Jay Billises, the Jay Williams, and, yes, Dick Vitale, talk about college basketball, they do have a bias toward East Coast and Midwest teams. Why? They see them more often. College Game Day, the pregame show for basketball, didn't do one show from the West Coast this year. Oregon was a contender in the Pac-12, maybe not nationally ranked as high as they are now to a one seed level, but they were in the national picture all season. Game Day didn't go west once. I don't have the explanation, and I'm certain that if there was something overwhelmingly compelling, they would have gone, but the fact is they didn't. The gentlemen at ESPN who work very, very hard, I have a great respect for every one of those commentators, Reese Davis included. They work incredibly hard, but it is almost impossible to invest time in every program in college basketball. So, because most of the population of this country is in the Midwest and the East, they tend to focus on Duke, North Carolina, Kansas, Kentucky. I get it. I understand it. All I'm asking ESPN to do is admit it. When Dick Vitale says on the selection show six times, I don't have a problem with Oregon, he does have a problem with Oregon. It's too obvious. He didn't agree with them being a one seed. He thought Michigan State should be a one seed. And Dick, if you didn't have a problem with Oregon being a one, but you want Michigan State to be a one seed, that means either North Carolina, Virginia, or Kansas have to come off a one seed. Well, you weren't going to demand that one of those schools give up a one seed. So guess what? You did have a problem with Oregon. And I just wish that he would come out and say it. All right. Now, on to one other thing about the Pac-12. As we're taping this today, I realize that I do the ASU women's basketball games, and so I'm a little more dialed in on women's basketball than you probably are. But I would just like to point out to you, if you're a defender of the Pac-12, seven Pac-12 women's basketball teams advanced to the postseason this year. As we tape this today, their combined record is 14-2. And the second loss occurred because it was in the women's NIT. Yes, there is a women's NIT. Oregon played Utah in the third round. So obviously somebody in the Pac-12 was going to lose that game. 14-2. For the first time ever in the history of the conference, they placed four teams into the Sweet 16. Washington and Stanford are in the Lexington Regional. I did mention Stanford, Oregon State's in the Dallas regional, and UCLA, unfortunately, is in the Bridgeport regional, which means, you know, if they win their Sweet 16 game, they get to match up with UConn. Good luck with that. Somebody asked me recently if the dominance of UConn is bad for women's college basketball. My answer to that is not entirely. Because of the dominance of UConn, we tend as a nation to talk a little bit more about women's college basketball than we might otherwise. I am a bit perplexed by ESPN assigning their number one announced team, Dave O'Brien and Doris Burke, to the first and second round games in Storrs, Connecticut, because they knew going in both of those games were going to be massive blowouts, and they were. I would think that you'd want to put your best announced team on the most competitive games. I don't understand it. They will also work the Bridgeport Regional, and that too has the possibility of being a one-sided game. My explanation about UConn is this. I make a clear analogy between UConn women's basketball and the dominance of the UCLA men's program under John Wooden in the 60s and 70s. Once John Wooden stepped down, the dominance pretty much ended. They were still very competitive under Gene Bartow, Gary Cunningham, and Larry Brown. Yeah, that Larry Brown took UCLA to a Final Four in 1980. But it was never the dominant program that it was under Wooden, and hasn't been since. Oh, they've won a national championship under Jim Herrick. Ben Hallam took them to back-to-back Final Fours, back-to-back title games. But they haven't been the dominant program that they were under Wooden. I suspect it will work the same way when Gino Auriemma decides to call it a career. I'm not really sure where UConn would go for a replacement. A number of his players are coaching at Division I schools. ASU played one of them in Hartford earlier this year, Jen Rosati. But there's also a couple of assistants that are worthy of elevation to the head coaching spot when Gino decides to call it a day. I just, personally, I just don't think that this will continue beyond the end of Gino Auriemma's reign in women's college basketball. There are too many good coaches and too many good programs to allow Connecticut to just continue indefinitely as a dominant program. Is it frustrating? Yeah, it's frustrating to go into this tournament and think that you have a chance when UConn is sitting there. Someday they will lose a game. Notre Dame beat UCLA in men's basketball in 1974, and it will make history when UConn loses a game the way that it made history for Notre Dame. We still remember Digger Phelps, John Shumate, who works as a scout with the Suns, and that program beating Bill Walton and UCLA in South Bend on a winter Saturday afternoon in South Bend, Indiana. So while I think that it's frustrating at times, it's certainly frustrating to try to get people excited about the chances of winning a national championship in women's basketball when UConn is sitting there. It will not go on forever. Someday, and I think the day is coming soon, the dominance will end. UConn will stay a strong program. They just won't dominate to the extent that they have dominated over the last 10 years. Okay, what else do I have on my mind very quickly? I wanted to say one thing about the dominance of Pac-12 women's basketball. If you're looking for a reason why the Pac-12 has suddenly become the strongest conference in college women's basketball, it's one major factor, and it's the Pac-12 network. The exposure of Pac-12 women's basketball and the revenue that's been generated from the network has allowed schools in the conference to, number one, hire top-notch coaches to run their programs, and it has expanded recruiting budgets to the point where they're keeping more good West Coast players. Washington, who plays in the Sweet 16 tonight as we're taping this, against Kentucky, has one of the game's great individual scoring talents in Kelsey Plum, who I do think will go on to play in the WNBA. Lots of other great talent in the league. I just wanted to point that out. The Pac-12 network, or conference TV networks in general, their impact isn't felt in the revenue sports, football, men's basketball. It's felt in the non-revenue sports, and it's paid off handsomely for Pac-12 women's basketball. The other thing, and I'm just going to mention this quickly, and I know I did this last year. I went to the ASU-Utah baseball game last night. There is a really great recruiting class coming next year for Tracy Smith. When he gets the ASU baseball program, and it is when, not if, when he gets that program to national championship contender status, Phoenix Municipal Stadium will be a phenomenal home field advantage for that program. It already is. It's a tremendous fan experience to go to Phoenix Muni for an ASU baseball game. But I'm telling you that when they get to the point where they're hosting regionals and super regionals, it will be a phenomenal home field advantage. Can't wait to see what happens when that occurs. And I did say when, not if, when. Listen, you want to know what's going on in sports locally? You're at the right place. Sports360AZ.com not only has the late-breaking information on everything from high school recruiting to the ups and downs of the pro teams, you also get a lot of really good feature articles, including one I intend to write about the 1975-76 Suns. I understand that a lot of you didn't live here at that time. So I'm going to write an article that explains the impact of that team and not just in a basketball sense. In fact, I'll give you just a little bit of a nugget as a tease. If you don't have the 75-76 Suns and what they did going to the finals against the Celtics that year, you probably, well, not probably, but you might not have the Suns in Phoenix. I'll explain in the article. In the meantime, I appreciate you checking out the podcast. And again, please send me a note. I don't want this to be a one-way conversation. I'd like to hear what you're thinking, and I'd like to get this podcast to the point where we're sharing ideas and questions with each other. I'd really like to do that. So the Twitter handle is at Moneyball, M-U-N-N-Y-B-A-L-L. I look forward to hearing from you. We'll have another podcast coming very soon. Appreciate you checking this one out, and I will talk to you very soon. Thanks.